It's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker today. It says here on his bio that he's a senior research fellow of the Center for International Studies, which sort of makes me smile. Because of course, we know Adam is something much more significant to all of us in his years as the Montague Burton Professor of International Relations here in the department, a position he held for a number of years, helping to build up the graduate program in international relations, the community of research that we have here, and indeed I would say the culture of research that we have here. Adam's been involved in a couple of major research projects within the department and also bridging other areas of the university. The Changing Character of War program, Adam was one of the Gang of Four who created the Changing Character of War program in its initial years, and also his very interesting and path-breaking project on civil resistance and power politics that he engaged with Timothy Garton Ash as well. A number of you will have read Adam's work over the years on areas relating to civilians, to humanitarian action, to broader aspects of international security. He was also one of the editors of the big project we did in CCW on the United Nations Security Council and war. I would say he's probably one of the driving editors of that project. But he's with us today to talk about a fascinating project that he mentioned to me a couple of years ago on the train, which I know brings together a number of his various interests. The title of the talk is on international order and violent extremism, but lessons from Sri Lanka. And Adam will be drawing in particular on the book that he's just recently edited that's been released by I.B. Torres, Democracy, Sovereignty, and Terror, Lakshman Kadiragamar on the Foundations of the International Order. So we welcome Adam warmly to the CCW and ELAC seminar. We're delighted you found the time to be with us because, of course, Adam's day job these days is president of the British Academy, so we know he doesn't always have the same kind of time he used to be in the department. So we're really pleased to have you, Adam. We are always open to questions at the end of these sessions, so we'll see how far we go, but we look forward to hearing your comments.
Well, thank you so much, Jennifer, and it's a delight to be back here, ladies and gentlemen, and to be addressing the particular topic that I have today. My presentation is about a really long-standing set of questions. Its central concern is whether the difficult task of containing movements designated as terrorist, and I realise that's always a controversial designation, can be conducted in a manner consistent with international norms, including those relating to sovereignty, human rights, laws of armed conflict, and democracy. It's well known that there are difficulties at every turn, and this has been evident in most societies that have faced a terrorist threat. Now, I must make clear at the beginning that I am absolutely not a specialist on Sri Lanka, and I'm sure there are people here today who know a great deal more about Sri Lanka than I do. One of them is Lakshman Kadigama's widow, who is here today. This is her sister, Priti, who lives in London. And I take a particular angle on the Sri Lanka conflict, exploring it through the prism of Lakshman Kadigama, who served as Foreign Minister of Sri Lanka for most of the period from 1994 until his assassination in 2005. I knew him pretty well. I first came across him in 1964 when he had just done a report which was the first ever report done on an international on the situation in a foreign country for Amnesty International. And he very much starts out life as a committed lawyer and committed to democracy and civil liberties. And that report, which is published in full in the book, was about the Buddhist movement that unseated the regime of Ngo Dinh Diem. That's how I happened to be particularly interested, because of my long-standing and incurable interest in civil resistance. 30 years later, I discovered that this same man as I had had a correspondence with by the old-fashioned method of air letters in 1964 was Foreign Minister of Sri Lanka. And then I discovered, to my surprise, that he'd been a student at my own college, at Balliol College, doing a B.Lit on the fascinating topic of strict liability in English and Roman Dutch law, which you can consult in the Bodleian Law Library if you feel inclined. It's wonderfully arcane because it's about a system of law, Roman Dutch law, that had ceased to exist in the Netherlands centuries ago, but had this extraordinary colonial afterlife in Sri Lanka and South Africa. And he was taught by Tony Honoré, who hails from South Africa and is still very much alive and kicking in his early 90s. He still runs seminars at All Souls. That was his peculiar and special interest. And I have to say that the thesis is largely about problems of drains and what happens when water seeps or sewage seeps out of one house into the ground of another. And by one of those wonderful ironies of history, a problem that I thought was totally arcane, arose in the case of two of the contributors to the book while the book was being compiled. Whether their lawyers consulted the Oxford thesis, I'm not entirely sure. We resumed contact when I discovered this connection with Balliol. He visited Balliol, I saw a lot of him. We elected him with acclamation an honorary fellow of Balliol, and that contact was not merely formal but intellectual. I found him extraordinarily interesting on the subject of terrorism, a subject which does not always attract the most subtle minds, and he was also extraordinarily realistic about the risk that he would be assassinated. He knew that it was highly likely, without being melodramatic about it. And on his invitation, I visited Sri Lanka in 2005 to give some lectures. So after his death, I felt somebody owed it to him to collect his major speeches and writings, and to give some account of his life and what he stood for. And I felt that that was a job that I really had to do. The world is not waiting to hear about the wisdom of a third world diplomat or minister on the subject of terrorism. It's naturally or conventionally assumed that we should listen to other voices, and yet I felt there was something here of value. And he struck me as an interesting figure for three reasons. First of all, as a young athlete, he had an interesting and privileged education within Sri Lanka and excelled at practically everything he did. And here he is in 1952 winning the South Asian 110 metre hurdles title. I think it was the second time he'd won it. Extraordinarily talented man, and his talents resulted in him taking a role in a very symbolic event, which tells one something about the Sri Lanka of the time, post-colonial Sri Lanka, having achieved independence in 48. This was a relay to celebrate the unity of the peoples of Sri Lanka. He's in the group on the left, third from the camera, quite hard to make out, but that's him handing a scroll to a young maiden of the same ethnic group. He's representing the Tamil group, and the scroll has a message about the unity of the peoples in Sri Lanka. And it was again in Colombo, half a century later, that he was cremated in Independence Square, Colombo, in circumstances that symbolized the divisions of the people of Sri Lanka. So in his person, he symbolizes the hopes that there were, not just in Sri Lanka, but in many countries, for the huge progress that there would be after decolonization. And that's what the Colombo exhibition was all about. It was the, as if you like, Festival of Britain, except with more of an international flavor. And then the disappointments his life symbolized with that cremation in Independence Square all those years later. So that symbolic role struck me as important. Secondly, he strikes me as interesting because he was quite exceptionally brave. After a long and successful career as an international lawyer, mainly with the World Intellectual Property Organization in Geneva, he chose to go into politics in 1994 at the age of 62, within months of the killing of his close acquaintance, who had preceded him as president of the Oxford Union. And that's Lalith Alathmudali, bottom right, who I think was the first Sri Lankan ever to be president of the Oxford Union. And that's Lakshman Kadigama, top left, who was the second. And the causes of Lalith Alathmudali's assassination are not known with certainty, but there is at least a suspicion that the government was involved. For it's a pretty remarkable thing in those circumstances to have decided to go into politics, a sign of bravery in itself. And Lakshman, as foreign minister, was to work fearlessly, despite the strong evidence that he was a target of the Tamil Tigers. He was consistently warned by the Sri Lankan police, intelligence, army, that he was a target because he was a Tamil. And the idea that a Tamil should defend the unity of Sri Lanka was obviously a betrayal that they could not tolerate. Hence the awful result. Above all, Lakshman represented, as I've tried to indicate, an unusual combination of beliefs. On the one hand, he had an impeccable background of strong commitment to democracy and human rights. Here he is at the Oxford Union making a comeback as a guest speaker in October 1959, opposing the motion that democracy is unsuitable for the underdeveloped nations of the world. Underdeveloped was that era's euphemism for developing, or the other way around. Developing is our euphemism. This was no mere youthful indiscretion. When he went into politics, he was and remained sharply critical of the employment of state terror. He explicitly said so in his statement of why he went into politics, which is in the book. He was very much the same person as the student at Oxford, maybe a little older and wiser, but with the same very strong beliefs. Yet at the same time, and this is where there is a dichotomy, he was quite exceptionally tough on terrorism. This, I believe, reflected the fact that whereas we in the West tend to view terrorism as mainly a threat against our own societies, actually, and those who have studied many third world societies I think would agree with this, much the bigger threat is to the fabric of societies that have less long historical traditions of managing a democratic system, and which are more vulnerable to ethnic or religious conflict or a combination of the two. It is actually societies such as Colombia, Lebanon, and Somalia that have been more vulnerable to terrorism becoming absolutely endemic, or Pakistan, one could add, than some more developed Western societies. Among his deep beliefs was the need for a serious, professional, and academically informed approach to the management of diplomacy and to our understanding of the world. And here's, that's him as foreign minister. Here's a poignant picture of him on the 12th of August 1995, on the day on which he announced the creation of a new journal, which he's handing to one of the contributors to our book, Nirupama Rao, who's now the Indian ambassador in Washington, D.C., was then in Colombo. And that's the first edition of a journal, the first issue of a journal that he had long wanted to create. And it was on that very day when he launched this journal on international relations that he was assassinated. A few basic facts about the Sri Lanka war, and please correct me where I make mistakes. And the first issue, of course, is it's very contentious to call it a war. Lakshman always avoided the term for reasons which are familiar to many who've lived in societies where they faced some kind of internal threat. They're reluctant to grace it with the term war. But the so-called Elam War between the Tamil Tigers, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Elam, and the Sri Lankan government can be said to have begun in 1983 and was fought in four main phases: 83 to 7, 90 to 95, 95 to 2002, and 2006 to 9, the last phase being, of course, after Lakshman's death. Now, this war was not the beginning of political violence in Sri Lanka. The country had had an unusually smooth transition from colonialism. It had had, I don't know what the British thought they were doing, universal suffrage since 1931, most unusual for a colony. And it was partly a reflection of a number of progressive British thinkers who really saw the empire in idealistic terms, particular eventuality occurred in Sri Lanka. But maybe that very lack of a liberation myth, of a prolonged struggle with a coherent single leadership, resulted in a certain fission in Sri Lankan politics thereafter. And in 1971 and 1987 to 9, there'd been an armed socialist uprising in the southern and central provinces, led by a party known as the JVP, and put down by Sri Lankan security forces with very considerable loss of life. Now, the Tamil question. This slide is taken from the last census that was of evidentiary value, taken in 1981, at which time there were, according to that census, the census results, 73% of the inhabitants of Sri Lanka were Sinhalese, 12% were Sri Lankan Tamil, 5% were Indian Tamil, and 7% were Moors, mainly Muslim. The sense of insecurity of the Tamil minority in Sri Lanka became serious in the mid-1950s, and it's an absolutely classic problem of the limitations of democracy when faced with a divisive ethnic conflict. We've had our version of those limitations in the history of Northern Ireland. And in Sri Lanka, they became serious. The Sinhalese Buddhist majority came was attracted by the idea of influence commensurate with their numbers, and linguistic nationalism was part of the result of that attraction. It was in contrast to the rather more elitist constitutionalism of the early years after independence. And its outcome was the 1956 Official Language Act, which made Sinhala the only official language of the state. Unsurprisingly, especially as many Tamils had traditionally worked for the state as clerks and civil servants and the like, this was followed by much opposition, especially by Tamils who had good reason to fear any threat to their identity and diminution of their access to jobs. This led to riots in June 1956, the first serious occurrence of violence between communities since some Sinhala Muslim riots back in 1915. And then it led to the May 1958 clashes between Sinhalese and Tamils, which were the first major outbreak against Tamils and in many ways a point of no return. As a result of continuing troubles over the language issue, there were various modifications of the Official Language Act, some convincing, more convincing than others. They reached the illogical conclusion in the Constitution's current Article 22, as it was modified in 1987. I'm trying to remember the detail of it, but it's something like, Sinhala shall be the official language of Sri Lanka. Tamil shall also be an official language. English shall be the bridge language. Now, if any of you can work out logically what that means, you're better experts on language than I am. And it failed to satisfy. It was too little too late, probably, to satisfy the issue at hand. By this time, the Elam conflict had been going on for 4 years. Now, this war, which went through, or conflict, which went through four phases, resulted in 2002, at which point Lakshman was in opposition. It resulted in a ceasefire agreement. And you can get an idea of the areas that are covered by the ceasefires being recognised by, held by the Tamil Tigers, as up in the northern province, up there, and then here these two areas in the eastern province. So those are the three main areas that were recognised as held by the Tamil Tigers. Now, there was no official map with the ceasefire agreement. The whole thing was done in a rush without the approval of the president of Sri Lanka, who represented a different party from the government at the time. So it wasn't concluded in the most propitious of circumstances. By this time, Norway was involved in an intermediary role. I tried hard to get a map, this map, from the Norwegians through the foreign ministry, through various contacts in the foreign ministry. And although I associate the Norwegians with efficiency and helpfulness, the map never came. Eventually, through a contact in the Sri Lankan Defence Ministry, who has been exceptionally helpful, I must say, I managed to get hold of this map. And I think the reluctance to produce it had to do with the extreme difficulty of actually monitoring the ceasefire, the ill-defined nature of some of the borders, the extreme disagreements over what the high security zones on the Sri Lankan government side of the borders actually meant, and so on and so forth. And this, just as background to the war, and then I will end my PowerPoint extravaganza. This is just to illustrate the situation in the immediate, or in the last few years before the highly controversial final campaign of 2009. The red areas are controlled by the Tamil Tigers. By this time, they've lost strong control in the eastern provinces, but they had partial control of quite large areas. They were operating, but without certainty. And then the yellow areas are those controlled by the government of Sri Lanka, but still claimed for the Tamil state. And one of the features of the conflict was the reluctance of the Tamil Tiger leadership, not always the most politically astute leadership, I have to say, to make significant compromises about the areas that they might control in some confederal arrangement. Now, I now just want to explore a few general questions raised by the Sri Lankan conflict and by Katagama's performance. First is it intellectually legitimate or merely propaganda for a government or citizens of a country to call a movement fighting for a minority people's homeland within it as terrorist? Now, it goes without saying that the term terrorist is highly emotional. And I remember years ago in a book I contributed to on the subject of terrorism, Laurie Friedman said that the description of terrorist is a victory for those who are in the anti-terrorist cause in any given case. It is highly emotional. And it is inevitable that some will use different terms. That's absolutely inevitable. And yet, we do need a term to describe actions which aim at assassinations, and of course actions which aim at civilians, aim sometimes at more or less random destruction, and which operate by inculcating an atmosphere of fear, not only against their adversaries, but also within the territory they control. And it seems to me that there is a need for the term, and to reject its use entirely is problematic, but to recognise that it is a difficult term, an emotional term, is right. Secondly, is it sensible for states outside a conflict area to proclaim one party in the conflict terrorist and to adopt legislation to prohibit certain kinds of support for that party? And that's one thing that Lakshman worked tirelessly to do. He worked precisely to get the Tamil Tiger movement declared to be a terrorist movement in certain countries where they were raising funds. And you can get a flavour of that from Lakshman's own speeches. For example, here he is speaking in Washington, D.C. in 2000. And he says, of the emigre Tamil population. And of course, emigre populations are often prone to feel guilty about their lack of direct involvement in the society from which they have fled and their desire to see it changed. It's not surprising, just as Irish emigres in America often gave money for the provisional IRA, it's not surprising that they should do so in these cases. And here is Lakshman in Washington saying, I don't for one moment say that every one of the Tamil emigres in North America supports terrorism. Most certainly and categorically they do not. The funding comes from, I would say, a small minority. The answer I used to get from foreign offices in this part of the world and in Europe was that they had no laws to deal with terrorism, especially the funding of terrorism. I was told this is a new phenomenon. Our legal system does not provide for combating international terrorism. We have old penal laws and so on. And he was entirely right about that, in the sense that, for example, in the UK, our definition of terrorism was one of planning actions within the UK or against the UK. It wasn't any kind of universal definition of terrorism. And he urged that there be changes in the UK law, specifically in a speech at Chatham House in 98. And eventually, that was secured. And after his death, he had a posthumous triumph in getting European countries, the European Union, and India, got that wrong, and Canada, to prohibit fundraising for the LTTE. So, in the particular circumstances of his case, there was, it seems to me, a powerful argument for what he was doing. Third question raised, is the theory that terrorism can be infectious and can easily become endemic in a society validated by the Sri Lankan case? To me, it has always seemed one of the major problems of terrorism that picked up or started by the right, it may get picked up by the left. Started by nationalists, it may get taken up by communists, or the other way around, or whatever. And whether one looks at the history of Cyprus or the history of Palestine, started terrorism movements, really gained currency with the Jewish national resistance, the Agun and the Stern Gang against the British, and then got picked up by the PLO. There is something to the theory of the infectiousness of such methods, and I think that without going into too strongly into medical analogies, which I'm deeply suspicious of, I do think that the Sri Lankan case, for reasons I've indicated, tends to support that view. Fourthly, are democratic political systems more or less likely than others to undergo terrorist attacks? As I mentioned, he was a firm advocate of democracy, and yet in his writings on terrorism, he recognised that actually it's very often democracies that witness terrorist campaigns because it's easier to organise in them than it is in dictatorial states. And so he saw what, at the very least, is a paradox in this situation. And particularly, of course, he was conscious of that problem of democratic politics, the majoritarian tyranny that leaves a minority feeling dispossessed or vulnerable to extreme leaders because democratic politics don't seem to yield results. A fifth issue. What is the place of negotiations and ceasefires in a struggle between a government and its insurgent adversaries? And here we have to confront Kadigama's own ambivalence on the subject. He reluctantly consented to the 2002 ceasefire agreement with the Tamil Tigers, but on certain understandings, and of course one of them was that there be progress towards a political settlement. He even went so far as to approve the deprescription of the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, even while he was encouraging their proscription everywhere else in other countries. And he had the agreement, for example, of the United States government on that course. They said, we're perfectly happy to go on keeping the Tamil Tigers prescribed, even if you deprescribe them in Sri Lanka. Because he did believe that there was a case for talking, because he profoundly believed that however destructive, stupid, or whatever terrorist methods were, a terrorist movement did represent a series of political problems that had to be addressed. And he would say that as a generalization about such movements, that they tended to have a social basis and that it would be foolish not to address them. And of course, he certainly believed in somewhat variable geometry towards movements depending upon the circumstances in which they developed. For example, I don't think he supported the idiotic, as I thought it at the time, British definition of the African National Congress of South Africa as a terrorist movement. There is a world of difference between a movement which has gone through some phase of organising attacks which might just about be construed as terrorism and being a systematically and consistently terrorist organisation. And the foolishness of the British government in that particular description, in, needless to say, echoing the United States government, seems to me to be an example of just how not to handle these problems. And in the book there's a lovely picture of Lakshman enjoying the company of Nelson, and Suganthi, I think, enjoying the company of Nelson Mandela. So he was discriminating, I would say, in these matters. And yet he also was the leading critic, or became the leading critic, of that ceasefire that he'd initially approved when he saw its consequences and the way in which it was being handled. And his speech in the Sri Lankan Parliament criticising the ceasefire about a year after it was concluded is a very powerful speech. It's forensic in its detail, and it suggests exactly why a ceasefire cannot be, if it allows continuing control of territory and continuing military and, for example, naval activities, cannot be a basis for permanent peace. Of course, there were numerous violations of the ceasefire. And it was a very impressive speech and a classic example of his toughness in relation to terrorism. Another issue, I think we've got to the sixth, can outside interventions, whether in the form of direct military involvement, third-party monitoring, etc., or UN role, be effective in a case of an insurgency such as that in Sri Lanka? And there had been the Indian intervention in Sri Lanka in an attempt to solve the war following an earlier ceasefire agreement, which wasn't a terribly clever agreement because it had been concluded between the Indian government and the government of Sri Lanka without the participation of the Tamil Tigers. This was, I think, before Lakshman became foreign minister. And this led to a massive Indian peacekeeping presence. And there, that too had badly broken down. And India had eventually to give up its peacekeeping role rather hastily. It was one of the Tamil Tigers' more foolish mistakes that they irritated and the Indians so much and attacked them so much And then ultimately they assassinated Rajiv Gandhi in India. And that act rebounded in their face, as so often happens with movements using terrorist methods. But that, the nasty taste left in the mouth of that attempted intervention in Sri Lanka was, I think, an indication to other powers that they were not likely to succeed in a major role. Although Norway came forward offering a different role, a monitoring role, and to some extent an intermediary role in connection with the 2002 ceasefire. And that, too, went pretty wrong. And there's a lot of soul-searching been going on in Norway about it. And when you think about it, there's a fundamental problem, not only in Sri Lanka, but in many countries undergoing civil war, that's really hard to escape. And that is the problem. Either an intermediary regards the two sides as in some sense equal, in which case they did things like, for example, suggesting that there be maritime zones controlled by the Tamil Tiger Navy and others controlled by the Sri Lankan Navy, or you don't treat them as equal. And if you do treat them as equal, you're naturally going to irritate the government of a sovereign state that feels that its cause is being undermined. If you don't treat them as equal, you will irritate the insurgent movement. And the Norwegians wandered into this situation without, as far as I can see, having very thoroughly analysed the structural problems and then handling it with a lack of finesse that was quite remarkable. I was in Colombo on an occasion when the Tamil Tigers had, in their infinite wisdom, shut off the sluice gates to an area in the eastern province that was largely farmed by Muslims. And all they had done was create a very large number of refugees. They could no longer farm their land. They fled, as they had to government-controlled towns. Then, after much outrage and opposition, the Tamil Tigers eventually agreed to reopen the sluice gates. And the Norwegian intermediaries made speeches about how statesmanlike the Tamil Tigers were being in allowing them to be reopened. You can imagine that didn't go down terribly well in Colombo, where it was felt that they had made too many compromises. And as I say, there's much soul-searching about this. As regards a UN role, Lakshman was a great admirer of the United Nations, but just as the British have been great admirers of the United Nations and active participants in it, but didn't want a UN role in Northern Ireland, so Sri Lanka was very much the same in respect to Sri Lanka. Not keen on a UN role, and for similar reasons. The UN is often caught in rather rigid positions. They may not be quick-footed enough to handle crises. They may be subject to political winds of change that are unpredictable, and so on. And so he was not particularly keen on that direct UN involvement, although he was keen to engage with the United Nations on matters such as human rights. He had written a major report on human rights before he became foreign minister, and on human rights in Sri Lanka, drawing attention to some of the most problematic features of government action in Sri Lanka, treatment of prisoners and the like, including torture. He'd drawn attention to all of that, and in office he helped to set up a human rights commission in Sri Lanka and the like. He was always willing to engage and to defend, even when some of the policies he had to defend were questionable. Next question, can the laws of armed conflict be applied by government forces in such a conflict? He repeatedly addressed army units, I've got the text of one of his speeches on that, or army training institutions, about the importance of the laws of armed conflict and human rights. and stressed how important it was that they be observed. You might criticise his speeches for being a little bit lawyer-like there, maybe reflecting his training in the Oxford Law Faculty, I don't know. But the emphasis was clear. It's a question whether that approach could have been more effective in practice than what we know happened in the final months of the war. And he particularly emphasised the importance of observing the laws of armed conflict if you hope to gain support within the international community and the adversaries community. Next, can counter-terrorism be pursued at the same time as the sovereignty of states is respected? And here, as a member of the non-aligned movement, although he was, I would say, less than wholly enthusiastic about the performance of the non-aligned movement and its capacity to think, he did clearly believe that the principle of sovereignty remained important in today's world, as anybody in a post-colonial state is likely to do. If you've been through the experience of colonialism and the damage that that has done, it's not surprising that you should be extremely suspicious of latter-day colonialism, and you should see European or Western involvement in other societies through a particular lens, not in the least surprising. And yet, he was nuanced in his views. He, for example, did not criticise, as far as I was able to establish going through his speeches, he did not criticise the NATO involvement in Kosovo. And when you consider the amount of opposition there was to it in the non-aligned movement, and especially in India, which is always Sri Lanka's big brother next door, it's very remarkable that he didn't join in that chorus. But he was suspicious of, or critical, I should say, of the United States' involvement in Iraq, and consistently so. And his ground wasn't just, although that was part of it, the lawyerly issue, as it were, a violation of sovereign state. It was also clearly simply a questioning of its prudence. Is it wise to be doing this? Is there a proper plan for it? Etc. Will the costs outweigh the gains? What will be the post-colonial order? An issue of which he was naturally always very conscious. And I speculate in the book that when it came to the violation of Pakistan's sovereignty with the killing of Osama bin Laden, it's an interesting question whether his pro-sovereignty beliefs would have outweighed his anti-terrorism beliefs. And I think that in that particular set of circumstances, he would probably have sympathised with the United States action, but that is speculation on my part. Lastly, and most difficult of all, and perhaps we can discuss it because it's high time I stopped, does the military outcome in May 2009 show that a terrorist movement can only be defeated in battle by the ruthless application of force? And here I would just make two comments, which both of them are somewhat critical of what one might say is the Channel 4 received wisdom in this country on it. The first is that actually a lot of the preparatory work for the defeat of the Tamil Tigers had been done by Lakshman Kadagama's patient work and exceptional leadership in the Foreign Ministry. The undermining of international support for the Tamil Tigers was one precondition for the outcome. Another was that following the willingness to negotiate and the participation in negotiations, the Tamil Tiger leadership in the East defected. And that couldn't have happened without there being extensive contact. And it was that defection of the leadership in the East with large numbers of Tamil Tiger forces who marched into government-held areas, and incidentally, as they did so, demonstrated the truth of what Lakshman had been saying for years, which is that most of their, or many of their soldiers were child soldiers who had been forced into the struggle, and they were that was the proof when the groups in the East gave up. So much of the work had been done before the actual final campaign. But lastly, there is a problem which I think is a problem for those of us who are interested as electors in the laws of armed conflict in the final stage of the struggle, which is a problem that I think has not been very squarely put. I take very seriously the UN report on the question of war crimes in the final phase and the killing of civilians in the fire-free zones, the no-fire zones, and so on. But the problem is essentially this. If, as did happen, an area is proclaimed to be a no-fire zone and civilians flee into it, and if, after that happens, the armed forces of the Tamil Tigers are under exceptional pressure, as they were, from the Sri Lankan army, what do? They locate quite largely in the no-fire zones. And that may be in violation of the rules, but it's not, frankly, terribly surprising that they should do it. And if the Sri Lankan army then sees that problem, it's not surprising, perhaps, although I find it deeply shocking, that they continue to fire against Sri Lankan military targets, even if they are in a no-fire zone. It's not just me saying that. Take this word from Fabrice Weissman, a very interesting article on Sri Lanka and all-out war. Sri Lanka amid all-out war, in a book produced by various members of Médecins Sans Frontières called Humanitarian Negotiations Revealed, the Médecins Sans Frontières Experience. And here is what Fabrice Weissman says. As the rebel territory shrank, the Tigers used increasingly violent means to dissuade the civilians from fleeing to government-controlled areas. The LTTE forced the government to choose between two ills: slow down or even halt the offensive, or commit war crimes. Now, I'm the first to be critical of much that was done in that period, but I do think that what is described there by Fabrice Weissman suggests something else as well, that there may be a problem in the notion of no-fire zones as enshrined or as developed from the laws of armed conflict. In other words, there's a paradox at the heart of this problem. Thank you.